24/7 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. It is Monday, November 25th. We've got a great show for you today. And Wednesday, we're doing our Thanksgiving special. But we're so cram-packed today, we need to go ahead and get started with two great guests, Supply Chains and SaaS. Let's go. Very excited to introduce my first guest. His name is Wes Bush. This is an incredible story. He is a SaaS, software as a service expert. He has helped hundreds of SaaS companies grow and become incredible business machines and has generated over $1 billion doing this. He took all of this and had a best-selling book a couple of years ago called Product-Led Growth, How to Build a Product That Sells Itself. It got some, let me check to get it precise, 927 five-star reviews with 500,000 copies sold. You really just don't get more impressive than that. But he has followed it up with a new book called The Product-Led Playbook, How to Unlock Self-Serve Revenue and Dominate Your Market with a Tiny Team, in parentheses. Wes, welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
So you said you wanted to talk politics exclusively, was my understanding. Is that true?
Yeah, just because you said I couldn't talk about it. So now I'm curious.
Well, you're not allowed to talk about is sex. We do not want to talk about sex. No sex, okay?
No. Well, luckily, my book has nothing to do with that. So we're good.
With which one? Sex or politics? Or is there a difference?
Oh, sometimes not, but no, not for this search.
All right, let's dive in. Tell me about the first SaaS business that you built. Let's go back in time.
Yeah.
History.
So one of the first ones I was working with is called a company called Vidyard. And so they made it really easy to understand, like, hey, like you're watching 50% of this video or not. And you could understand exactly who that person was. So kind of creepy, but at that time, like for videos, that was really unheard of for marketing analytics. And so, yeah, that was one of the first companies I had the experience of working with to make them product-led.
All right. I guess we better define product-led. Give us an example. Can you give me a non-SaaS example also? Is that possible?
100%.
Okay, go.
So like most people have experienced some sort of like product-led sales motion, which would be something like, hey, you go to the airport, you try on like cologne, perfume. You wouldn't call that a product-led experience, but it is. It's something where you can try before you buy and see if you like it. And so it's been like, it's nothing new in that sense. It's been existing for a long time. However, when it comes to the software space, that's been really hard to do for a really long time. And so now it's becoming a thing where we gave it a new label to be like, oh yeah, that's a product-led company. But it basically means like they make it really easy for you to try the product before you buy it. And they have like some sort of free trial or freemium motion where you can get started for free.
All right. So it's freemium then. I mean, we all understand that, and great description of it. And you're right. That's not just a SaaS idea. That's been going on for thousands of years. So
yeah, definitely.
Why is that so hard with software? I'll give you access for a month, and if you like it, then you can keep going.
Yeah, it's hard to pull off because a lot of times people don't know, like, what do you give away for free? Do you give away this feature or that feature? And then when it comes to what you promised them, it's like, well, okay, here's like this free widget. You can do this free thing. But then there's also the issue of, well, how do we get them to experience the value of that? as quickly as possible because you can't handhold them. They got to do it on their own. And then the last piece that's actually really hard to pull off is pricing. It has to be self-serve. So they got to understand, like, okay, which price makes the most sense for me? Which plan is right for me? It's got to be simple, but it's also got to scale. So like somebody could sign up with a $20 per month plan and it could grow into, you know, $2,000 per month on that same plan. So I guess that's the part that makes it a little more complicated than like, hey, this is a perfume or cologne example. Try pre-buy.
Yes, I am going to try before I buy a cologne. I know that for sure. And I guess that's a really good example. So when we're dealing with software in particular, has there been sort of or any company that's done it really well that we all know of? Is there a company that built their whole model using this freemium idea?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm trying to think of one myself, and I can't think of one. Can you?
Yes. I mean, if you've used Slack or Microsoft, those communication tools all use them. Zoom is something, a lot of people have used. So Zoom has done a fantastic job, especially during COVID. That's how they grew. A lot of people are like, oh yeah, I can have a free 40-minute meeting with somebody. Fantastic. There's also like Google Docs as well. Like that's completely free. And there's some other companies like Miro, which is like a digital whiteboard, essentially. That's also product-led. Dropbox, also very product-led. Like you get a certain amount of free gigabytes for free they can share online and upload. And you get more if you also share it with other people. And so those are some of the most common examples that a lot of people know about.
Yeah, I knew every one of those. All right, I didn't really realize how prevalent it was. When we talk about the upgrade, what percent should be upgrading? If everything's going well, Wes, and they've got the systems right, what percent should do the premium upgrade services?
Yeah. So it depends on the model. So for instance, like a free trial, like you give people a certain amount of time for free, let's say 14 days as an example, that could be as high as like a good model if it's optimized, could be as high as like 20% of people upgrade. However, you'd usually get less people signing up for a free trial since it's not really as compelling as a freemium motion, which a freemium is like, hey, listen, if you sign up for Canva.com or even Dropbox, it's like you get a certain amount of capability forever. You get 10 gigabytes forever, or you can create any sort of graphics you want with basic tools forever. So freemium is like the ultimate customer acquisition model because you do attract a ton more signups. But on that side, when it comes to upgrades, you do get a lot less people that
on Canva for years and I've never upgraded it. And I introduced it to my 9-year-old daughter and she loves it. She loves graphics and stuff. And so she actually asked for a Canva upgrade for Christmas. And so I was blown
That's
away.
Awesome.
I'm sorry, what?
That's amazing. Good for her.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to get the kids computer savvy. The son last Christmas built a computer from scratch. And he was 11 at the time or something. Totally built it from scratch.
That's more capable than me.
Yeah, I couldn't do that either. He knew stuff that I didn't know. He had done research that I hadn't done, which was really impressive. You know, he knew all the bit settings and all of the really, really technical stuff. We're actually editing a video now and going to put it up so that it can be part of his college application, you know? So, anyway, that's the strategy. All right. The difference between the two books, the second book here, I think there's going to be a 3 eventually in the library. The playbook, is it a step-by-step plan as I would associate with a playbook?
Yeah, very much so. So the first book, Product-Led Growth, How to Build a Product and Sell Itself, that one was all about, hey, like, understand what this is. New approach. Here's exactly what it is. Is it right for your business or not? So that's kind of like the main outcome of that book is it right for you? the product-led playbook, literally at the very beginning, I'm like, hey, don't read this book if this is not for you. Like, if you're not in the, like, Kool-Aid of, like, I know what growth is, it's for me. Because this is literally, like, the step-by-step nitty-gritty of here's how to do it, how to think about it, and how to roll it out in your company. So that's kind of how the two books differentiate.
All right. And what's the book number three going to be about? Am I right that there's going to be three in the series?
Yes, actually. So the third book is called Product-Led Onboarding, How to Turn New Users into Lifelong Customers. And so this third book, it's really focusing on one of the nine components in the product-led playbook. It just goes way, way deeper. And it's, we identify like the onboarding piece is the 80-20 essentially of if you want to get this strategy right, you have to get users to value very quickly. And so that just goes through another framework to do that at a much higher level.
All right. Nine steps, you said, right? Or stages?
Yep, you got it.
Can we go through that quickly? Or some of them to whet appetite? I think we're going to start off with strategy, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's nine components to the product-led playbook in like three phases. Each of them has three components. And the first phase is all about like, how do you build the foundation for your business? Because a lot of times people will think like, hey, you know what? I like this product-led thing, but let's just slap on a free trial or call our product free and see if it works out. It usually doesn't work out that well. So you got to have that strategy. The first component is just that. Like, how do we tie our company-level strategy into what we're doing as a company? And then the second component is really building off of like, who's the ideal user? This is not the ideal buyer, which we're usually very familiar with. The ideal user is the person who's actually using the product. And so we got to understand what success looks like for them. What does their user journey look like? Because we have to enable this person to see value. And then once we understand that.
Let me interrupt for a second. Is the user different from the purchaser in the fact that I, as the CFO, am going to buy Dropbox for the entire company, and then all of the users had better benefit from it so that they come back to me and say, damn, I love that Dropbox thing you just added. Is that what you mean? The difference between the two different players?
Correct. Yeah. So in that Dropbox example, how it would typically play out is, a company, let's pick a big one like Amazon. All right, so Amazon starts using Dropbox in like one team, then it starts spreading. And then eventually Dropbox might actually reach out to the buyer that says, hey, listen to the CFO, you have 1,000 people using Dropbox. And these files are shared all over, like to increase security and everything else. We should probably centralize this on our enterprise plan. And so there is like that mix of, okay, you got to empower the user and then you got to follow up with the sales side. In some cases, that's why it's confusing. And like when you're selling B2B or to other businesses, but yeah, you're absolutely right. There is that buyer and then there's the user that actually goes through this. And so the main strategy difference is it's much more bottoms up. People who are the users will start using it, and then it will usually bubble up to the top, that decision maker to make that sale.
And do you do anything to encourage that process, or does it happen organically only?
It's a bit of both, and it depends also on your price point. So if it's like super low price point, then yeah, it should be a little bit more organic. But in a lot of the companies we work with, it is, you should have sort of a strategy around that. Like, okay, let's say a promising company signs up, they add like 2-3. Up for them and make sure that they really get the most out of this product. And so you can kind of do that hybrid approach. And I think that's the best of both worlds. You use humans where it makes sense and you automate the rest when it comes to like, okay, we're not, creating an installation for every single new person that signs up for the product. Let's just automate that.
All right. Before we go back to the different steps, I think we are number three now. Does this strategy matter what the price point is? Does it work just as well for a $1,000 product as it does a $100 product or a $10 product?
Yeah, this is really important because let's say your entry-level plan is like $5,000 per month. that's not really going to work that well, because you're going to have to talk to people most times, unless you just have a ton of brand trust and people are like, yep, I get it. And the value is like insane in this product. And so that's why one of the sixth component we haven't got to yet is pricing. And that's like a core pillar of this, because you do need to have something, I call it a value metric, where it's like in the email marketing space, as an example, it's like per contact. Okay, if you have 1,000 contacts, it's $50 per month. If you have 100,000 contacts, well, it's a $500 per month. And so as your customers grow and scale with you, you can also grow and scale the amount you charge them. And so the best product at companies, they could start off with a low price point, easy entry-level price, and then people can grow into multiple thousands of dollars per month organically at the end of the day. And so it's not as much about like, you know, is there a price point where you can't do product led? But I would say it does actually matter a bit, where they can start with a low price point to get started, and then they can always expand as high as you want.
So we love theme parks in our family. It's a great way to trap the kids and make them spend time with you. And so we do a lot of theme parking. We've been to Disney here in the last month because attendance was down, and there was a report the lines were the shortest ever. So I was like, well, we got to go then. And we're signing up already for the new Universal Studios. They're opening a new theme park in May, and I already have my tickets for that. I'm taking the family. Very interesting, though, incentive differences. And my wife and I were talking about it last night. Disney, when they are slow, they will do the 25% off. And you can watch TV, and if you see a 25% off on Disney, you just know that their sales numbers are not hitting the expectations, or they wouldn't put the sale out. On the other hand, Universal does a different strategy. They are a 3-day strategy. So if you come for one, we'll give you a day free or something like that. Right. That's not the strategy they have right now because of their new theme park. Their new park is you buy 3 tickets and we'll let you have one of them into the new park. Which one of those works better? What's the difference between just giving me a discount or giving me a free extra? Which one do you like better?
Yeah, I mean, both of them solve different problems, right? Like the 25% off, it's really incentivizing a lot of people. Like if you are an individual or something like that, like, hey, great. I want to go to Disney. Sure, I can go alone. Whereas like Universal Studios, what they're really trying to incentivize is bring your family. It's, you know, buy 3 tickets, get one free. And so they're really trying to incentivize getting more people to there. And so it all comes down to what is the intention of the pricing plan. And I think a lot of times, whether it's a SaaS product, it's, you know, a theme park, it just comes down to what is the main goal. I think at the end of the day too, when you look at like Disneyland versus Universal Studios, they might actually attract the same number of people at the end of the day. So it really just comes down to which one's most effective. And are you trying to bring more families or more individuals for people to sign up for your product?
All right. Interesting. All right. Let's go back to the book number 3, please.
Yes. So the third one is all about what the heck do you give away for free? Now, a lot of times, and I'm guilty of this too, it's like, okay, let's slap on a free trial. Let's make this SaaS product or whatever it is, 14 days for free. And very common to do, yet it's not intentional.
I hate those because you have to put in your credit card and then you get slapped later. And then what is this bill? I don't remember this. Then you have to go and cancel it. I just hate that offer.
Oh yeah. It's my least favorite one too. And like not all free trials have those. Where it's like, okay, give us your credit card. You could do, it's called like a opt-in one where it's like, okay, sign up completely for free. And then if you like it at the end of the 14 days, you got to give us your credit card and opt into it. So there's lots of different models out there, but what really matters is there's actually some sort of like transformation. When you think about somebody signs up for our product and they get to experience the value where there's like a before and after difference when it comes to the product. And so like with cologne and perfume, it's super easy. It's like, you know, before you recorded it, you stink. And then it's like after, you hopefully smell good. Or if you really didn't like it, you're like, oh man, now I have like a few hours of smelling like this terrible cologne. Had that happen to me too. But it's like thinking about the before and after, like you've got to have that in your model. And so the best free motions, they all have that kind of transformation at the end of the day. So once you understand what that is, you get really intentional about, okay, this is what we got to give away for free. Then you get to move on to the next three steps, which is all about your go-to-market motion. Like, how do we actually bring this to market and sell it, market it, all that fun stuff. And you got to have the fourth component, which is your offer. Is it irresistible? Does it speak to that ideal user we're talking about earlier? Does it relate to, like, does it include free motion that you talked about? And does it really motivate people to sign up and get going with it at the end of the day? So that offer is extremely underrated. And the main intention there is just to get people to sign up on that end.
All right. Does that bring us back to pricing?
Almost. So once people sign up, the next step is onboarding. And that's really looking at, okay, you sign up for the product. How do we get you from point A of like just signing up to point B of that first strike in the product or experience where you're like, yes, I get this. Like when you buy that Disney ticket, it's like, okay, great. We did that. But like, maybe it's that first ride. Maybe it's that experience where you're like, man, that was a good decision. I love that. And had a great experience with kids and all that stuff. So really nail down what that looks like. Get people there as fast as possible, because in software, it's like, honestly, you lose people so fast. And 40 to 60% of people are just not coming back. So once you get that, you get people the value, then yes, you're onto something. Pricing is next. And that's when you can actually upgrade people, because at that time, that's when you've allowed people to try before they buy. They've experienced something useful. You've served before you've sold. And now is the time where you can actually say, hey, it's not free. If you'd like to continue on this journey, this is the next level. And you can upgrade on that end.
All right. So back to Disney. I want your thoughts on this. A lot of people are believing, and there's a lot of media talk about this right now, that Disney doesn't care what their prices are, and they're going to continue to raise them at an astronomical rate because they'd really rather have fewer people that spend more versus a lot of people that spend less. So now you have to go and buy the, you get in, and then now they're offering, you know, skip the line type benefits, which you can spend hundreds of dollars there. And it's very easy now for a family of four without food and without any gifts, no merchandise, to spend $2,000 for one day of Disney. What are your thoughts on crowding your customers out? Because I'd really rather have only IBM and I don't want you. And I can think, I thought of another example. The Atlanta Chamber of Commerce used to have 5,000 members with 30 premium members like Delta Airlines and Home Depot and Coca-Cola, and then 4,970 small business members. And they said, you know what? We get 99% of our revenue from the 30, and we get 150% of our problems from the small business. The hell with all of them. We're getting the now. To be a member of the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce now, you have to be a Fortune 500 company. There's only 30 members now. The hell with the rest of you. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, it is such a fun question, because it really comes down to who is your ideal customer and who are you trying to attract? So they probably have an ideal customer profile out there that is, you know, really well off, is okay with like $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 per month. And they realize that there is like whenever you
not
charge
a month,
that
a
amount,
a day, Wes.
A day, yes, which is crazy. And so then by attracting less people, they're also going to have potentially a better experience, because although they're making the same amount, for those people, it is less lines and everything else. They feel like they get a better experience. And so that all comes down to, what are they trying to optimize for? Is it like this ideal customer, smaller crowds, better experience? And then also for Disney in this regard too, it's kind of an interesting concept of like, do they want to make this more of a, you know, once in a lifetime experience for some people, where it's is not that frequent. It's like, oh, I remember that time I went to Disney once and it was the most magical place. Everything was perfect. And it does kind of play into that too. If you think about it, the more expensive it gets, the less frequent it would be, the more memorable potentially if they do that right on that experience front. So I'm not saying that's like absolutely the right thing to do, because I think, you know, it's a business at the end of the day, but I can argue both sides of like, there is a strategy there. And when they're thinking about how they consistently raise it, do I think it's right? Probably not, but there is something there to it.
What about the chamber getting rid of 99% of their members?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the same thing. Like, who do you want your ideal customer to be? And that is one of the hardest questions and decisions you have to make is like, who do you want to attract? Because if you want to be, vanilla ice cream, you're bland at the end of the day. Like, some people love vanilla ice cream, but if you want to be something to somebody in your market and become the obvious choice, sometimes you do have to say, okay, this is exactly who we're for. And the pricing reflects that. And you think of like other membership groups like YPO, Entrepreneurs Organization, like they're prohibitively expensive for a lot of entrepreneurs. But then you think about, oh, they're attracting the entrepreneurs that are like 1 mil and above. Okay, that makes sense. You would have to have that amount of money for it to make like a no-brainer decision for you to join. So it all goes back to who are you trying to attract? And that's okay sometimes for you to say no to 90%. I think a lot of times companies should say no to 90% of their customers to focus on the 10% that provide the most value and are the best. That's goes right back to Richard Koch's book, The 80-20 Principle. A lot of times in every business, there's 20% of customers that generate 80% of your value.
Unbelievably, in our next interview with Art Koch, we talk extensively about the 80-20 principle, which will be coming up in about 20 minutes in the show. So pay attention for that. We have another discussion of this rule in just a minute. Wes, I would rather charge. I don't sell something if it's cheap. Everything I've ever sold has been the highest price point in the market. My first business ever was summer camps. The average summer camp is $150 a week. Our summer camp was $500 a week. What are your thoughts on this, on my bias that I would rather sell high-end stuff versus low-end stuff? The last thing I ever want to do is buy something of mine at Walmart, you know, because it's Walmart. You know that the margin there is as low as possible. I don't want to be in that marketplace. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so you kind of broke up a little bit on that end. You started with like, I want to sell something at the highest end of the market. Yeah, it's such a fun question because it all comes down to what is your strategy at the end of the day? Like, I have this quadrant since, you know, consultant life. Everything's got to fit into a 4x4 graph. And on the graph, there's like high cost and then there's high value. So if you think of like the spectrum, like, low value, high cost as well on that end. There's like the dominant player in any market, they usually have low cost and high value. And that's really the sweet spot. If you think of like something like Netflix in the early days, it stands out. It's like, wow, I can get all of that for, you know, the same cost of renting one, but it's also high cost. So if you want to be a differentiated player in your space, that's not a bad place to be either. And if you want to sell high cost, at least be high value, and you should be if you want to stay in that specific area. And so those are kind of like the two main strategies, like dominant and differentiated. There's one more, which is disruptive, which is, you know, you are low value and low cost. So in the early days,
Japanese cars at the beginning.
Yeah. And even Canva, as an example, like Canva versus Photoshop. You know, Photoshop, you can do so many things, but Canva, you know, lower value, can't do as much with it, but it's low cost, it's free. It's a disruptive strategy. And so really, it kind of boils down to those three strategies, like which one best resonates with what you want to do and what kind of aspirations you have. Want to dominate the market? Do you want to disrupt it? Do you want to have a differentiated approach? And that kind of lens leans more towards like, well, in your response to the question, it's like, well, if you're doing differentiated play, fantastic. Do charge the most in the market, but also bring the value that's really unique to that specific buyer.
We were at Stanford and MIT. So we provided the value. You got your kid on Stanford for totally. The summer. So Wes Bush, the product-led playbook, how to unlock self-serve revenue and dominate your market. How do we find out more? Follow online. Get a copy of these great books.
Yes. So I got an exclusive gift for everybody who's listening is I'm going to go give you the book completely for free, the audiobook. So if you want to get a free copy of the product-led playbook, you can go get it at productledgift.com on the house.
Fantastic. Product-led growth or book. What was it again?
Gift. Product-led gift.
Gift.com.
No spaces, no capitals, all one word.
Wes, thank you so much. Great, great, great information. I can see why the book sold so many thousands of copies. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'd love to have you back when book three hits.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
We'll be back in just a second to talk with Art Koch about supply chains and that 80-20 rule. We'll be right back. We are back in again, so very appreciative that you are with us. Let's change topics now. We're going to talk about something that we haven't talked about in quite a while, supply chains. And the idea that your supply chain could actually be a profit center as opposed to a big cost. Please welcome Art Koch to the show. He is a supply chain expert, has just written a new book on supply chain that is 5-star rated on that Amazon place with a bunch of reviews. Pretty impressive. The book is called The Supply Chain Revolution, Unlocking the Sustainable Profit Chain. He is the president of Arthur Koch Management Consulting and has saved his clients hundreds of millions of dollars, has led to billions of dollars in market value increases. Art, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Jim. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. All right. Supply chain is the last thing I think of when I think of profit centers.
Okay.
Am I alone or is that normal?
It's very normal. I always feel, you know, the big Fortune 100, Fortune 200 companies, large companies, they kind of have, for the most part, they have a handle on it. They don't look at it as enough as a profit center, but definitely mid-size and smaller companies. It's kind of like a redheaded stepchild, and it's a forgotten department that too often is filled in with non-professionals and individuals that do not have enough background in procurement or supply chain.
All right. Very interesting. Let's back up and talk a little bit and lay some foundation first. Tell us about your career and how you got to this point. How'd you get started in supply chain? Did you grow up wanting to be involved in supply chains?
No, I grew up wanting to race motor. I grew up wanting to race motorcycles and cars, and I realized I didn't have deep pockets, so I had to do something. Actually, I grew up as a journeyman machinist, and I watched what happened in Flint, Michigan, where I grew up, with the automotive industry shrinking and dying for the most part. And the gentleman I worked for said, you know, you need to think about doing something different. So I applied, used the classes that I took for my journeyman's card as getting me in the door at University of Michigan. And from there, I didn't look back, got my bachelor's degree in chemistry. And then I kind of looked and said, you know, I like the shop floor. I like operations. And I went to Michigan State to get an MBA in operations management.
And who have you worked for along the way? Have you been a consultant your entire career, or have you had some corporate gigs as well?
Corporate gigs. I spent 20 years in corporate America. For example, I worked with a small startup by the name of Certec that was bought by Lucas Industries, now part of, went to TRW ZF, went to Avery Dennison, Went to a big wholesale and distributor of books called Ingram Book Company, part of Ingram Management. Went over to Aerospace.
We know them.
Yep. Went over to Aerospace and went to A.O. Smith, now part of Rigo Beloit. And what I did was purposely I watched what happened in Michigan when I was growing up, and I saw so many of family members and friends of family where they worked for General Motors their entire career. And when GM was forced to shut down a facility, these people were great people. They knew their job, but they were obsolete to the outside job market. And I said, I did not want that to happen to me. So I purposely jumped companies every 3 to 5 years in industries to where I could learn as much as I could, because I knew when I got about 50, 55 years old, you know, I didn't want to be obsolete. And it paid off. It really paid off, because I feel I have a great foundation across companies. And it's hard for people to pull the wool over my eyes.
So, Art, I want to ask a really stupid question. As manufacturing decreases as a percent of the American economy and service businesses become more and more important, does the supply chain disappear? Does it just move overseas with the manufacturing? Does it become less relevant if it's overseas? Is it easier to forget about as a Fortune 500 CEO because all of that's taking place in Asia now and I don't have to worry about it? How does the change in the macroeconomics affect the supply chain?
For years, I've been discussing and trying to get people to listen that the idea of moving all of your work overseas would cost your business more money than keeping it local or regional. And what happened was companies, as they did mass globalization, they protracted their supply chains to have all these different fingers around the world with different suppliers and trying to get them moved together. And it worked pretty well, still was costly. It worked pretty well until COVID happened. And when COVID happened, that disruption showed how fragile everything was. So to answer your question, if you move it overseas, you even need to worry 2-3 times as much about your supply chain than if you had it locally or regionally.
Very interesting. I wouldn't have thought that. That's great insight, though, that you worry more.
You should worry more. Maybe they don't, but you should worry more.
And have we bounced back from the COVID supply chain disruptions? I mean, it's been 2 years now. Are we back to normal? Will we ever be normal?
You know, what's happened is we're kind of normal, but what's creating problems is the war in the Middle East with Israel, Hamas, Iran, and the such, and what's going on in Europe with Ukraine and Russia are causing a lot of problems within the supply chain. Then dovetailed into that, there's been issues with the water levels in the Panama Canal, which has required
certain
super tankers have a hard time going through it. So just to, you know, how to add something to the question you asked a minute ago, whether you agree with what happened or not, you have to admire what occurred. But the Israeli government tapped into the supply chain for Hamas and planted bombs within their pagers and cell phones.
Yes. One of the coolest security stories I've heard in a long time. Again, regardless of what side you're on, you got to give them, you know, credit for what they did. It's an amazing little trick.
Jim, absolutely. So what you think about, if somebody wanted to sabotage your company's the product that you're moving from overseas, you don't have it in control. So as they're protracted, that risk is higher and higher. And you see what's going on with cybersecurity. I know in the future we're going to see more with supply chain security across countries that do not play well together, or even a company in a remote part of the world that wants to put a dent in your personal brand of your corporation, it's pretty easy to do.
So inventory, huge part of the supply chain. And I think the conventional wisdom is that you want inventory. And then the Japanese have come in and done this just-in-time stuff. And I know I did enough research about you, Art, to know that you think inventory is evil, to quote your word, right? Evil, strong word.
Absolutely. I use that term on purpose to get a visceral reaction from people that are listening. Exactly. So first and foremost, if you're selling a product, you need to have inventory to service your customer. No ifs, ands, or buts, right? I agree with that. However, the reason why inventory is evil, inventory is placed to hide or mask problems. In a perfect world, you would just need one piece flow or one piece ready for the customer. But you have to stage inventory throughout the logistics and manufacturing process to make sure everything flows together. So by having inventory, it hides problems. As you hide problems, it delays problem resolution. And if you're delaying fixing problems, that's costing you hard-earned profits. That's why I say inventory is evil.
You know, I came of age, actually, Art, living in Japan. I did my MBA in Japan and worked for some Japanese companies, worked for Coca-Cola in Japan, worked for the Japanese government even for 2 years. And they're so proud of their inventory systems. When I was working for Coca-Cola, they were sponsoring Disney's Space Mountain at the Tokyo Disneyland. And I was able to get my MBA class and a tour of the underground facility at Disney Tokyo, which is not nearly as big as it is in Orlando, where they built an entire office building underneath Disney. Yeah. I don't know if people know that, but there's an office building underneath Disney World in Orlando. And they didn't do that in Tokyo. But anyway, we got underneath and they took us to where they keep the stores for the junk souvenir shop. And they had it so well timed that they replenished the storage area underneath the retail store every 30 minutes based on sales. And the guy walked in and he brought a half case of stuff. And our guide said, "Why'd you bring a half case?" And he's like, "That's what we anticipate that we're going to sell in the next hour."
Yep.
And that's how detailed they were. It was amazing to see. It just blew us all away with how well planned it was.
Yep.
Is Japanese businesses still the leaders in this with the just in time and all of that? How is China doing with their manufacturing? Are they reaching that level of capacity and that level of ability?
From my travels to China, I'm seeing the Western businesses bring lean processes into the operations, into local logistics. However, where it kind of falls apart, or absolutely does fall apart, with the logistics of moving the product to the West, to Europe, United States, and that's where you get the protracted supply chain. So they're following a lot of the same principles, but with the distance between the countries, it's harder. And something to add, Jim, I did an independent study in Japan and South Korea when I was in grad school, and it changed my life seeing how they did things. So most eye-opening experience I've ever had.
It is amazing. All of the Asian countries, I'm still particularly impressed with the Japanese success. It's going to be very interesting to see how they figure out a dwindling population. We'll talk about that in a different topic, different time.
Yeah.
What about forecasting? It seems to me that all of this is tied to great forecasting. And I, again, know that you're not a huge believer in the accuracy of forecasts, right?
I literally tell everybody forecasting is always wrong and you need to get over it. And if somebody could forecast things perfectly, they would not sell their forecasting algorithm to us in manufacturing. They would use it to predict the stock markets around the world. They would use it to predict weather, crop cycles, things of that nature. So if they're selling it to you, that means they haven't figured out the things that give you the most value. What I recommend companies to do, they have to compress their lead times, and instead of trying to forecast the top level product that you're built into where you're delaying product definition as long as possible until you actually know what the customer is going to need.
You have a trademarked principle or rule, I guess, the Art Coke profit chain, the total cost of ownership method. Can you walk us through a basic understanding of that?
Jim, what I did was I created a house because I felt it was a good visualization for people to see. And at the bottom of it is a foundation, and that's what's taught in school. Procurement, logistics, warehousing, transportation, materials management. And I worked my way up to work with the pinnacle of sustainability. And the pinnacle of sustainability is customers that are loyal and they always come back, where your profits are predictable and sustainable, and an organization where individuals aspire to come and work. And in the middle of it is taking all the body of knowledge that's at the bottom and expanding on of how you apply it. So many times when you get out of university, you have great young men and women, but they have a great body of knowledge, but they don't know how to apply it, and they're expected to make the jump all the way to the top of the organization on how to get profits and how to get loyal customers. And that's hard when you're just right out of school the first 5 years. So that's what the attempt I did.
And that's so interesting. And I'm just thinking a lot of things, Art. And that's why so many ex-military people go into supply chain, because they at least have some experience, I would assume.
Absolutely. They're moving equipment, people, food, spare parts around the world. And they have great procurement, great logistics, great people skills. So they fit very, very nicely into businesses. Don't do enough of that. We don't do enough of hiring our military personnel into businesses.
One of my closer friends that was in the military went into supply chain and has had a great career now based on that. I want to be a little bit mean for a second, Art. One of the very first chapters in the book, and it's very similar to what we were just talking about. I think chapter 2 talks about building professionalism into supply chain. And you just mentioned they come out of school with no experience versus the Army. I want to tell you a little personal story. 30 years ago, I started my first business. It was a summer camp business, teaching kids computer skills at Stanford, MIT, Georgetown, UCLA, SMU, Sorbonne, Cambridge, Oxford. And it's 5 years in, we were running 89 different summer camps simultaneously all across the country. At any one given minute, I'd have 40 operations running with 15,000 kids in it. And our job, I realized, was to get the right gear to the right school. And we became a supply chain business in a lot of senses. You can't have computer camp if you don't have 50 computers in the room. And you have to move them around. We would do 2 weeks at one location and then pack up the entire thing like the circus and move it to a new city. We would close Friday at 4 and be in a new city operational Sunday by noon, and wow, had to take everything down, pack it up, reassemble. And I became a supply chain expert because that's what I had to deal with. And here's the question. Over the years, I hired every friend that I had. That's where my employees came from. I had a friend who needed a job. I hired him. The worst, my least educated friend was the person I put in charge of my supply chain. He had never done supply business before, but he was my least educated friend. And so he got my worst job running the warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the exact opposite of what you're teaching us to do. And luckily, he was good. He was good. And we never really had any supply chain issues. But that's because we spent 9 months getting ready for a 3-month circus run.
Okay.
You know, I got damn lucky that I would put my worst employee in the most important spot, didn't I?
Well, what you did was you coached them, mentored them, and developed them along the way.
He's got an amazing job now.
Right. You just didn't throw him to the wolves.
No, I spent more time with him than anyone else.
Yeah. So, Jim, you did the right thing. And that's where I come back. If you see in a later chapter, I talk about finding genius in the castaways. So you had a person that might have been a genius, but was never given the opportunity to bloom. And you trained to develop him and give him the opportunity to bloom. So I'm really harsh in that chapter about building professionalism, because it's part of getting a point. And I'm perfectly fine with the vocational route within all businesses. But it cannot just be 100% of the people in supply chain, because it's so costly, that are all vocational. And it cannot be just one person at the top that's been educated in supply chain, because they're always trying to sell and teach the vision of where they're going. You got to have some in the middle that are dragging you along with it. But you also, what I call the storytellers, the people that are the tactical people that come up through the ranks, those individuals are the storytellers that weave everything together to make sure that you don't bump your head in the middle of the night and make major mistakes.
What's the law of 1%?
What I see in businesses everywhere I go is, you know, you hear people talk about the 80-20 rule.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. I take and I do 80, 15, 4, and 1. And what I found universally through every business I've been at, the last 1% of sales or the last 1% of purchases equate to 50% of your customers, 50% of the products that you sell, or 50% of your purchases or suppliers. And people ignore that. They say, oh, if we work on the top 80%, the profits will come. And I'll scream at the top of the hill saying, in the short term, you're right. But in the long term, it's not sustainable, because people cannot focus that long on that top 80% if they're all the times being ate up below them on this 1%.
Very interesting. Very interesting. That makes me think about the developer who's building a skyscraper, and they make their profit on the last 5 units that they sell.
Yep.
So yep. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Art, what percent of businesses get your grade A?
What percent of my businesses?
No, not your businesses. A? Businesses out there.
You know how I feel you get a grade A is if you're always working to improve and you're engaging your people in reducing lead time, and from, you know, not month over month or quarter over quarter, but if you look at a stretch of 6, 9 months or a year and you're improving, I will come in and say you get a grade A. If you have your head buried in the sand, I'll say you're a failure.
The supply chain revolution, unlocking the sustainable profit chain, 5-star rated on Amazon. Art Koch. How else do you want us to find out more about you, follow you online, all of that, please?
Yeah, go to Arthur, KOCHMGT.com. That's my website. You can find me underneath Art KOCH on LinkedIn, or Arthur Koch Management on LinkedIn, either way. And you just Google the supply chain revolution, unlocking the sustainable profit chain. You'll find me on Amazon.
Fantastic. Art, thank you so much for being with us. Great information, and congratulations on a well-selling book.
Jim, thank you for including me into your family and letting me talk with your listeners. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, likewise. Great information. We are out of time for today. Ooh, I forgot. We have Thanksgiving. This is our last show before Thanksgiving. All right, what are you doing for Thanksgiving? Do you have big plans, or are you coming to my house?
I'll come. No, my wife and I, we've had a very challenging year with family issues, and what we are doing, we are going to have a nice little Thanksgiving at our house, just her and I.
We're out of time, but back Wednesday with our special Thanksgiving show. Bye now.